We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, I'm excited to be joined by Matt Stoller, who is the author of Goliath, which is a book you should absolutely check out if you haven't yet, and has a fantastic Substack that you should make sure to subscribe to as well, called Big. Matt, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. I mean, you've been writing about consolidation, actually, in an industry. A lot of people are suddenly noticing there's a ton of consolidation in, and I feel like that's across the board, whether it's meatpacking or Hollywood. But I want to start with Hollywood, because as we're recording this, there's suddenly an interest on the right on Disney's record of consolidation and Disney's monopoly status and all of the protection that Disney has been afforded by the government in many different ways. But Matt, can you actually just tell us or walk us through how Bob Iger took Disney and made it into what it is today? A lot of people might not know that Disney actually owns everything from the History Channel to GoPro. I don't know why they need to own GoPro, but they do.
I didn't know they owned GoPro. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So there's Disney, which kind of people historically think of, you know, the Disney World and you know, animation and whatnot. And then I think ended in the 90s. And then there's what we have today, which I thought a really good way to characterize them was Imperial Disney. This was a Hollywood writer who wrote about it. And Imperial Disney is not a result of, you know, studios that were, you know, that made a bunch of great animation and maybe were sort of nasty about copyright or whatever. But it was a result of mergers, right? And changes in regulation. So the big purchase for Disney was in the 90s, was when they bought ABC ESPN. And that was a result of pulling down some rules called the financial syndication rules, which were designed to say that nobody who distributes content through primetime TV can also own that content. And it was intended to make sure that there were open markets for content production. It's very similar to something in the movie industry called the Paramount Consent Decrees, which was in the 1940s, that said that Hollywood studios couldn't own theater chains and vice versa. That way you wouldn't, you know, a theater chain could just choose movies that they thought would do well instead of being forced to pick a certain number of movies. And this was sort of the same thing in the TV area. Well, so they got rid of the financial syndication rules in the 90s, and immediately what you saw was consolidation and what's called vertical integration, where a producer buys a distributor or vice versa. Disney bought ABC, ESPN. And then in the 2000s, and that was under Michael Eisner, but under Bob Iger, they bought a bunch of other companies. So they bought, Lucasfilm, so Star Wars, they bought Marvel, they bought
21st Century Fox.
Pixar. Yeah. And then the big one was Fox, right? And they launched Disney Plus, which, you know, was competing with Netflix. And that was a way of kind of combining both TV and movies and getting around both Paramount consent decrees and financial syndication rules, both of which, you know, FinCEN had been pulled back, or they got rid of it, but Paramount consent decrees was still sort of in play. But the net effect of the vertical integration and then all of these mergers with Disney, but also across the rest of the industry, is that now you basically have six or seven firms that control kind of all content. I mean, all entertain, you know, scripted and non-scripted content. I mean, you have YouTube, I guess, but you know, it's not like that's not a monopoly, right? Right. Oh, we'll go run into the arms of Google. But you know, effectively, you know, this has had a lot of significant impacts on the creative communities and what people can say and what audiences can, like whether consumers are getting what they want. And the other thing that happened, I think, in the 90s and 2000s, this is the other big piece that Bob Iger did, was the globalization of these firms. So mm-hmm. Disney invested huge amounts in China, I think Disneyland, and there's a big Disneyland there, and NBC Comcast, they did the same thing, Universal Studios in China, and also in Paris and other places, but China's the one that's of concern. So what has essentially happened is you've dramatically consolidated the number of producers and distributors of entertainment, both scripted and non-scripted. And then you've also globalized it and enabled the Chinese basically control of our content by, or at least veto power over our content by the Chinese state, because, you know, they can just say, well, you have whatever, 12, 15, $20 billion invested in China. If you like that, then ESPN is not going to talk about, you know, what the Houston Rockets said, right? When that manager, talked about Hong Kong. So that, you know, we have this situation where you're seeing an erosion of free expression domestically, because you have just the markets for content are gone, right? You just seven streamers, and, you know, Disney's by far the most powerful one, but just seven, right? And no, if you make something, you can't get it distributed, right? One, you know, there's a lot of frustration about, I'm a Democrat and progressive, and there's a lot of anger and frustration that Black people don't have, you know, they can't get their own content out. There's underrepresented communities that can't get their content out. But conservatives should be concerned about this too, because if, you know, you remember The Passion of the Christ, mm-hmm. that Mel Gibson movie, that would not be able to be released today, right? You could not go to one of these seven streaming companies and get them to release it. And if you did, they wouldn't necessarily, like, people wouldn't, they don't have to pay for it because there are no markets, right? You're just a subscriber. And so you don't see these kinds of, like, you know, you wouldn't see a, there was a bunch of really great shows that came out in the 1970s and 80s. And then parallel in the movie industry, New Hollywood in the 60s, and 70s, that was really a result of the Paramount consent decrees and the breakups. And then FinCEN in the 70s, that was like, you know, Sanford and Sons and All in the Family. And like, you know, eventually weird shows like Seinfeld, right? Which was not particularly successful for the first couple of years. That was an independent producer. And shows like, you know, Mary Tyler Moore, like shows that had people who were not featured. It's like a network executive wouldn't have said, oh yeah, let's do a show with this kind of person, but they had to, because they were like, oh, well, if we don't buy it, you know, ABC will buy it. And the thing is that gave power to people who are creative and said, you know, I think I know, I have something to say. And then it also gave power to audiences who were like, yeah, that's a story that we want to hear, whether it's, you know, Mary Tyler Moore or whether it's The Passion of the Christ or whatever, whoever is able to get into these markets and distribute content, they get to be tested in the marketplace. And what's happened with this consolidation is that there is no marketplace anymore. There is just, you know, can you please the person at Netflix or Disney or Discovery Now? They just had a big merger. And if you can, they'll put you, you know, they might, you know, sign you to a big contract and pay you a bunch of money, but you won't own the content. And you won't have any data about how it did. And no one is paying for it because it's all streaming. So you have no idea how any of it did. And then you have like something like Amazon, right? Or Apple, where streaming is really irrelevant to their business. And so they actually don't care. I mean, at some level, they're not focused. They don't even have to make money on this stuff. So they can sort of stick stuff in front of you, right? And you might be an Amazon Prime member because you want to, you know, buy socks or whatever, with no shipping charge, and you're just going to get, like, they're going to stick content in front of you. And so that's like not even, you know, there's no market at all there. It's just, you know, the arbitrary whims of some, you know, rando in Hollywood who gets to choose what they think the people will like, but there's also no feedback mechanism. So Disney is sort of part of a broader problem, which is just, you have this tremendous consolidation. And I think the thing is there's a lot of partisanship around Disney, you know, particularly with the Don't Say Gay bill, but also kind of other things that they've been doing. And I think one of the things that gets lost here is, whereas sort of left-wing culture activists and right-wing culture activists, they think that they have a really strong moral case. And they're saying Disney should do what we think Disney should, you know, Disney should wield power in service of our agenda. No, Disney should wield power in service of our agenda. And I think the broader argument should be it's not appropriate for Disney to be wielding political power over our social choices. Like, Disney is a company. They can hire, you know, who they want. They should, you know, have control over their own internal operations. And there are social decisions that you have to make about that. But they shouldn't have the power to make social decisions for our broader culture. That power should be vested in the public through our elected representatives and through our, you know, community organizations and things like that. And that's what consolidation really does, is it undermines the ability of people in our society to make a society, right? And to, you know, and I think that's really the crisis that we're facing. And that's a little bit, I think there's a sort of a distraction because of the, you know, bitterness, the social bitterness that we're facing with one another.
Yeah, so that's, I want to narrow in on the audience power element of what you just said, because we talk about this when it comes to social media platforms. You know, for instance, Facebook and Twitter, their content moderation power is totally downstream of their market power. I mean, there is no right. audience power. They're not responsive to what people want in the market, and they've made it so that you can't. That there aren't competitors who can be responsive to that. So how do we see that in Disney and now perhaps with Amazon and MGM, and we see it, I mean, gosh, you could just go down the board, Viacom, CBS, I mean, all of these different places. Now that a lot of conservatives may be saying, hey, we're not taking the family to Disney World, we're going to cancel our Disney Plus subscriptions. In a normal environment, that might have more power in the marketplace, but it seems that Disney has created an environment for itself where there's a lot of sort of fungibility and a lot of cushion, a lot of ways to cushion the blow from audience choice.
Yeah, I mean, the choice is, so this is an interesting question, right? So financial syndication rules, they were put forward by Nixon's Federal Communication Commission. They put forward these regulations, and they didn't say, hey, we want more black characters on TV, or we want gay characters on TV, or we want conservative characters on TV. Nobody at the FCC said, you know what, we really need to have Archie Bunker as a character on TV. Like that, nobody made that determination. But what they said is we need to have open markets for content, right? And the result was you had all of this weird stuff that went on TV, and some of it worked and some of it didn't. And so I think when you're today, you have seven firms and that all, you know, that they're streamers and they are vertically integrated, right? So you have, they produce and they distribute and from, you know, and they have just power over the whole industry from the, you know, producer to the, you know, independent producer to the consumer. And if you, even if you're like, if you're Sony, right? Sony has a studio, but they can't get their content out, right? It's really hard for them. You know, they can't license anything to Netflix because Netflix is like, no, we're only going to send our own, you know, our own stuff, or Disney, or, you know, it's like they used to be able to license to different networks, but now all that distribution is centralized. And so what's happened in place of the social decision that the FCC made in the 1970s to say, we want open markets so you can have weird stuff that creative people put forward, and then the audience is going to watch what they're going to watch, right? After that, we're going to have seven people effectively make all of these decisions. And you can turn it off. That is certainly your choice. But that's basically kind of all you can do. And then, and what you don't, you know, and that's on the consumer side. On the you know, creative side, like what you don't see, because this is, you know, it's the industry, right? On the industry side, there is tremendous fear and trepidation on the parts of the people that actually make this stuff, because they are now at the, you know, beck and call of seven people, you know, in Hollywood, you know, a few more than that. But essentially, like, it used to be that if you made a good movie that was successful, you had a lot of power to, you know, basically make another movie, right? And you could, I think, who was it, John Hughes who did Home Alone?
Yeah.
You know, I think, you know, Home Alone was this sort of weird movie where, you know, Macaulay Culkin was like exceptionally violent towards like the Joe Pesci. Like it was a super violent movie. Like, I don't know if people remember that, but it was like, you know, like giant metal things falling out. You know, it was kind of like a weird movie, right? But John Hughes had been successful in making other movies. So the studios were just like, okay, you know what? Like, you get to do what you want. Cause if we don't let you do what you want, then some other studio is going to let you do what you want. And we know you made a lot of money for us last time. So we'll just let you do that. And it was like this fantastic, you know, fantastic movie. I mean, I liked it, whatever. If you don't like it, you know, then, you know, you're not American.
Maybe you're just a violent person, Matt.
Right. Yeah. Cause everybody who liked Home Alone is a violent person.
Yes. It's just the American thirst for violence against.
Yeah. Yeah. You're very judgy today.
I know. I'm sorry. I'll try to control the judgment. Life is already complicated enough, so what if getting term life insurance to protect your family could be easy? Fabric has moved life insurance all online, so getting a policy that's right for your family isn't complicated at all. Fabric was built specifically for parents to help you manage your family's financial future like a parenting pro, stress-free. Fabric's new lower prices mean significant savings over other providers, with great policies like $1 million in coverage for less than $1 a day. Everything is on your schedule with Fabric because it's all online. Less than 10 minutes to apply and you could be offered coverage instantly with no health exam required. Then just personalize your quote to fit your family's needs and you'll be set with high quality, affordable protection for your family. Fabric is fully backed by Vantas Life, one of the most trusted names in life insurance since 1847. So you can feel confident you're getting a high quality policy that meets your family's needs. With Fabric's online hub, it's quick and easy to track your family's finances all in one place. Get fast, affordable life insurance, create a will for your family, set up your kids' college saving plan, and even establish a rainy day savings fund. Planning for the future has never been easier. There's no risk to apply today. Fabric has a 30-day money-back guarantee, and you can cancel at any time. Protect your family with term life insurance now in just 10 minutes. Apply today at meetfabric.com/Federalist. That's meetfabric.com/Federalist to start protecting your family today. meetfabric.com/Federalist. Fabric Insurance Agency policies issued by Vantas Life. Not available in New York and Montana. Prices subject to underwriting and health questions.
Yeah, no. But, you know, the what's happened now is that level of power of the creator, right? And this was true kind of across the board, from the hot writer to the, you know, the actor and
Norman Lear, like you were saying.
Norman Lear, or just, you know, like any, that power doesn't exist anymore, right? So, because you can't, you just, the for a couple of reasons, but the main one is that, you know, there are no markets, right? Mm-hmm. So if you kind of release a movie, right, you don't know, like Netflix is releasing all these movies or Disney is releasing all these movies. And, you know, they say, oh, look, we had 1 billion hours watched on this movie. But you don't know if somebody would actually go to the theater and pay for it, right? Which is a different kind of transaction, or whether, you know, an advertiser on TV would advertise against it, right? You just don't know. You're guessing. And also, all of this data is privately held. So you don't know if whatever Netflix tells you the audience is, that's all you know. There's no like Nielsen's doing a third party. And then there's no aftermarket for like DVDs or syndication, right? Which was where a lot of the compensation came from for the creative community. But it also, you know, was able to put a value on content. All of this valuation that we used to do, which was, you know, the initial like, advertising, the upfronts, the box office returns, the syndication revenue, the DVD sales, all of those ways that you can actually put a value on content would basically just figure out what audiences like, is gone. So we're just guessing, right? And the people who's guessing, it's like these seven people in Hollywood are guessing. And by the way, they want to merge more, right? Like,
yes.
They all think that they're going to be more mergers, and they think that they're going to shrink from 7 to 5 or from 5 to 3 or you know, and, you know, Netflix just missed earnings estimates the other day and their stock dropped, you know, their stock has gone down by like 50-60%. And of course they're going to say, well, you know, someone's going to need to buy Netflix. You already hear these rumors.
Yeah.
So this is a consolidated industry that is going to get it, not is going to, because I think the antitrust division is going to sort of start to step in. And I think Congress is going to start to step in. But this is an industry where all the executives think that it's going to consolidate. And so we have to, like, I think it's really time for public policymakers to start to say, look, this market is too consolidated. It is bad for America. It's good for China. It's bad for America. And it doesn't allow us on the left or the right to be able to express ourselves and to have that debate over what we want to be as a society.
And speaking of it being good for China, Netflix, if it gets consolidated, if it gets snatched up by someone else, is the one streamer that's not in the pocket of China yet. It hasn't been let into the Chinese market. And so it still has things, the leeway to run things like American Factory, that great, actually Obama produced documentary that came out a couple of years ago. And before we get into those sort of structural questions about the antitrust movements, I think momentum right now, I also just, this is somebody who is not an expert in this issue asking a question. If you say want to boycott Disney for a reason on the left or on the right, these Disney and, you know, Viacom, whatever it is, they own these like huge percentages of movies that are in theaters and then the back catalogs too. You know, all of the TV shows and movies that have already been produced right. are sort of owned by just several, as you said, they're in the hands of just this handful of people. So if you want to kind of back out of that marketplace and you want to sort of speak with your pocketbook, vote with your wallet, does it make as much of an impact if you're just, you know, trying to boycott Disney and then tuning into the History Channel? Is that not also sort of chipping away at consumer power?
Yeah, so there is, you know, boycotts don't tend to work when there's a monopoly,
yes.
right? You just, unless it leads to political action, right? So the Boston Tea Party was the result of a boycott of tea. But it was the ultimate goal was political action. It wasn't, we just are going to boycott the, you know, East India Company until they, you know, allow more different types of tea in the market. That was never, they were like, no, this is about our liberty. This is a political problem. And we're going to deal with it through our political institutions. And the boycott is in service to that larger political goal. And, you know, there's plenty of boycotts where that is the point, but pure consumer boycotts, they work if your goal is to get the company to change, you know, like change its behavior. Like if you don't like let's say you don't like a new flavor that Coca-Cola came out with,
right.
and you organize like a boycott, like that might be a way to get Coca-Cola to change their behavior, but it's like, it's a consumer preference model. But if your ultimate goal is political, then boycotts alone don't work, right? You can't vote with your dollars. It doesn't work like that. Boycotts make sense, but only in service to a larger political goal. You cannot boycott Amazon. You just can't, because most of the internet is run on AWS. You are not going to stop using Amazon, even if you think that you're stopping, you know, that you're not using Amazon. You are using Amazon. And that's true for Google. And it's true for a lot of our kind of core infrastructure plays. You are using them, whether you think you are using them or not. And you not using them doesn't really hurt them, because they have market power that they can exploit in lots of different ways. So if you don't use Facebook, Facebook still has basically, you know, they have enough data that they can essentially go without your data. They can essentially figure out who you are by like a composite of a bunch of people who are like you. They don't need you, right? And it's fine to boycott, you know, and you can see this because, you know, whenever there have been attempts to boycott Facebook by either users or advertisers, it has literally no impact on Facebook at all. Sometimes it helps Facebook. In fact, it helps their advertising revenue. So when you have a problem of dominant market power, consumer boycotts don't work. And it's a good thing to boycott if it's in service to political action, right? So if you say, let's boycott and ask our political leaders to strengthen antitrust laws so that they can break up Disney, that is a useful thing to do. But the other thing is I don't know about boycotting Disney. You know, Disney's great. You know, everybody loved going to Disney World as a kid. It's a magical place, and it's not fair to deny that to your kids, right? I mean, if they really want to go to Disney World and you can take them to Disney World, like, that's not a fair thing. We shouldn't have a public policy regime that sets up a situation where people have to make that kind of choice, right? And that's, I think this is a public policy problem. I don't blame Disney for this. I blame Disney for lobbying, right? I blame Facebook for lobbying it. But, you know, aside from that, they are following the rules that we set up, right? And these rules were set up in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. And they were set up to facilitate the consolidation of power because we thought, not we, but what we policymakers thought, that consolidated power was more efficient, right? Cheaper, more stuff, better stuff, right? And it wasn't, I think it didn't work out that way, but now we have these Goliaths, right? And if you want to address that problem, I mean, and these guys lobby aggressively to maintain their power, right? And I think that they shouldn't do that. I think that's bad. But aside from that, I think the real issue here is up to policymakers, right? It's about saying, let's remove the privileges that these, you know, that these companies have. So just to give you, like, and I think there is an alignment here between the left and the right. And I'll just give you, you know, Abigail Disney, who, you know, is a, I think she's the niece of Walt Disney, or she's the granddaughter or the great niece of, anyway, she's very left-wing. And she's very outspoken against the conservative movement. But, you know, I asked her about Ron DeSantis's attempt to get rid of the special economic zone for Disney, or calls, Laura Ingraham's call to break up Disney. And she said, yeah, I'm totally, you know, I'm totally for what Ron DeSantis wants to do there. I don't like Ron DeSantis at all, but she's for that. She's for what Laura Ingraham said in terms of breaking up Disney. And so it's not, you know, this is a, I think there is an alignment here saying, let's just get these firms, like, let's just say to these firms, you are not allowed to wield political power. And then we can fight with each other.
You've written a lot about the history of sort of structurally how we got here. And that's really interesting to me, kind of looking back on some of these mergers that in retrospect seem insane. I mean, it seems insane to me that some of these were approved. And maybe that's, you know, hindsight is 20/20, but looking back, it's remarkable that we had a sort of climate where these things happened and conservatives supported it or shrugged. Even some sort of establishment Democrats would have supported it. Can you talk to us a little bit about the sort of philosophy and how it's been baked into the structure here that, you know, creates a country that allows, for instance, that Disney and Fox merger? It just seems, again, in retrospect, insane.
Yeah. So let me, Disney Fox, first I'm going to start by picking on Bill Clinton.
Yes.
Who is the worst man alive? Maybe Henry Kissinger too. I'm not sure. It's always a, you know, Anyway, so Bill Clinton is the guy that got rid of financial syndication rules, right, and allowed the Disney ABC merger, right, at Disney ESPN ABC. So that's kind of started the Imperial Disney kick, and that also was the Telecom Act of '96. That was a big, you know, that was a way of consolidating radio and consolidating, like, television and, you know, all of these different, and that was bipartisan, right? That was Bill Clinton president and a Republican Congress, and everybody thought it was a good idea to get rid of rules that prevented all this consolidation. So that was in the 90s. And then you get to 2019, where the Trump administration allows Disney and Fox to merge, right? Which was crazy and really, like, really changed Hollywood in ways that were pretty devastating. So the philosophy behind both of these, like the Telecom Act of '96 also included Section 230 of the, you know, which is, you know.
Oh, funny.
Yeah, weird, right? but that's also when we deregulated shipping, which is why we have traffic jams at the ports. But anyway, whatever. What are we, you know. the basic idea behind a lot of the sort of removing the ability of public institutions to set rules, over markets, right? Which is what we did prior to the early 1980s, maybe like late 70s, early 80s. You know, the argument that for, you know, was called deregulation, but really it was about moving rule setting power, governing power from public institutions to private institutions, and then relaxing antitrust policy. So facilitating more mergers and allowing, you know, more allocation of markets, more things like vertical integration, just basically letting big companies get more powerful. The idea there was, look, you know, we have this big lumbering government, we have these big labor unions, and it's all like kind of a mess, right? We have the inflation of the 1970s, and, you know, the things are not really working, they're not efficient. And, you know, the left was kind of like, well, we like big stuff because we get to socialize. You know, when you have big stuff, then all, the government only needs to like talk to a few companies to change things. Like if you want to change all our light bulbs, right, just call Walmart, right, versus having 10,000 stores. And then the Republican side, they were like, well, you know, we want the new kind of conservative movement under the Chicago School, which was the libertarian movement. You know, they thought, well, if you have big business, that's just more efficient. And all these small businesses, you know, independent businesses, they're just not good at doing stuff. So it's totally fine if they get destroyed, because that's, you know, that is the way of capitalism, right? They redefined capitalism to mean placing effectively governing power in the hands of people that we call CEOs, but are really at this point politicians. And that, you know, there was a third group, this sort of traditional, you could go back to like a Teddy Roosevelt or an Eisenhower or a Brandeis. You could go all the way back to Thomas Jefferson. You could go to Frederick Douglass. There was this tradition that you go back to the 1600s that was about self-government and preventing concentrations of economic or political power, right? Checks and balances. But in the commercial realm, it was, let's put constraints on what corporations can do. We'll have them compete with one another, because when they compete, they don't try to take over the government because they're too focused on competing and building a better service or product, as opposed to like, oh, well, there's no one else around, so let's focus on monopoly maintenance through lobbying, which is what happens when firms merge. So that was the general like philosophy in the 1970s. In the 1980s, they said, no, we don't need to think about power. We need to think about efficiency. There were sort of different flavors of that. And then they argued in the 80s about marginal tax rates and things like that, welfare. But they both agreed effectively that consolidating power in the corporate sector was a good thing for different reasons. You know, and like the Democrats with the Obamacare was about consolidating power in insurance companies and hospitals and pharmaceutical companies, and then putting a regulatory overlay on it. And that's the same thing with Dodd-Frank. That was about consolidating banking power and then saying regulators get to have, you know, get to play with this new consolidated nifty banking system. But the Republicans, it's very similar, except they just didn't want the regulator there. They wanted the Mark Zuckerberg to just do the regulation without some, you know, nerd in DC telling, you know, making suggestions about what he should do. But either one you accept, is about allowing consolidated power. You know, some person in New York or San Francisco or you know, Chicago or wherever, to be making decisions for cities all over the United States, whether that's in banking, whether it's in retail, whether it's in movies, whatever it is. You know, what we can buy is going to be determined in Bentonville and Seattle. What we can borrow is going to be determined in New York. What we can see is going to be just, you know, determined. We can watch is determined in LA. You know, how we communicate now is determined in San Francisco. And this is really crazy. This is a really crazy way to do things. And it is not what we have ever accepted in America on the right or the left prior to the 1970s. And so what we're seeing now is this revisitation, particularly around antitrust law, which is what I focus on. And antitrust law is the law, the legal framework designed to look at monopolies and market power, things like cartels and price fixing. And then also, you know, using a dominance of a firm, whether it's Microsoft or Standard Oil or Google, to control that market and extract profits. That particular area of law is seeing a revitalization. And there are bills in Congress that will likely pass. There is more energy and interest at the Antitrust Division, at the Department of Justice, at the Federal Trade Commission, which polices our markets, and at state attorneys general, which have a lot of different cases that are pretty interesting. So just to give you like one, I think, data point. So maybe 3 years ago, there was interest in antitrust law, but not really a lot of action. And now today, there are five different government antitrust cases against just Google, right? And at different levels. So the best one is Ken, in my view, is Ken Paxton's out of Texas. But there's federal ones, and there's other state ones. There are two cases against Facebook, government cases. There is a case against Amazon, and there's likely going to be more cases against Amazon and Apple, and probably more against Google. And now I think you're gonna start to see more as people realize, oh, wait a second, we don't just have a market power problem with big tech. We have market power problems with, say, Disney, or Discovery or other media channels. You're going to start to see more interest in changing the rules around that, around those sectors. And you're also seeing interest in changing rules around independent pharmacies and what are called pharmacy benefits managers, which are sort of a middleman in the sector. You're seeing interest from cattle ranchers around meat packers, and cattle ranchers are very upset, as are consumers of beef. So you're seeing like all of these parts of America that are kind of coming alive to the problem of market power that don't map onto partisan lines. And I think the big challenge, so I'm a Democrat, but I've lost my taste for partisanship. And we've been working on the Democratic side, like there are different factions of the Democratic Party. We've been working for like 5 or 10 years on building out new ways of thinking about market power questions, new philosophies, new methodologies. And we've had some success within the Democratic Party, not like total takeover, but we've got some good enforcers in positions of power. And on the Republican side, I think that you guys started thinking about this maybe like 2 or 3 years ago. And
oh gosh, don't let me in with the Republicans.
Well, the conservative side. I don't mean like the Republican Party, but I mean like your show's
conservative
name is Federalist,
movement.
Right?
Yes, yes, yes.
You guys are conservative, right?
Yes.
what I mean is conservatives have thought about this. There've been like more the Republican voter is much angrier about market power questions than the Democratic voter traditionally, like that's what we're seeing in polling. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the establishment itself, like the people who think about policymaking, I think the Democrats we've been thinking about this for longer. Mm-hmm. And what you have on the right is more interest in saying, you know what, we really do have a market power problem. And the fight is like slightly different. So it's just that the libertarians on the Republican side of the aisle are pretty powerful. And the Republican establishment is still, I think, it's changing, right? There are like Clarence Thomas has come out and said some interesting things. There are a bunch there's a bunch of politicians who are coming out and saying, no, we actually do have a market power problem. And we need to we need to make changes here. And it is as you put it, it's upstream from the cultural problems. The market power issues, but it's a fight, right? And it's a fight that we're having on our side of the aisle. It's a fight that I think the conservatives are having on their side of the aisle. In my view, it's a downhill battle, but I think it's also it's also a difficult battle because there are just these constant attempts to wedge us apart based on our views on different, I think, cultural questions, which are obviously really important, but are also not like, they're also used and manipulated to obscure some of the things that we do agree on.
Yeah. And in a healthy society and a healthy economy, you sort of can hash those out in the marketplace, both of ideas and like literally in the marketplace. That's what used to happen. And especially in entertainment, where a lot of these cultural questions are litigated. Rachel Bovard makes a good point. She always makes this point about even, Bork and some people in the Chicago school, if you're a true libertarian, you should be so disgusted by cronyism and consolidation in ways that I don't think necessarily translate to today's crop of libertarians that oppose a lot of this antitrust, a lot of these antitrust questions. And just to segue from the point you made, Matt, I wanted to get your thoughts on inflation and consolidation. You brought up meat packers, and I think you have made a really persuasive case on your Substack, which people should make sure to subscribe to, that a portion of inflation, and folks may disagree on what that portion is, but a portion of inflation is very much a byproduct of consolidation. This shows up in surveys of retailers, automobile retailers. You can sort of go down the line and look at different sectors of the economy. What does that look like? What is that sort of, where do we see that connective tissue between price hikes and consolidation in the economy today?
Yeah, I mean, so, okay, I guess about maybe in the 1970s, there were probably 50 different shipping firms. The easiest way to look at it was kind of two areas. One is semiconductors, where we basically have one high-end semiconductor producer, and that's in Taiwan. It's Taiwan Semiconductor. That's a big problem because... You know, something like 3/5 of our industry, manufacturing industries, are reliant on semiconductors. They're not all from Taiwan. A lot of them are less sophisticated ones, but there's consolidation problems across the semiconductor industry. And so that leads to higher prices because, you know, if you just can't get enough semiconductors to produce whatever it is, it could be, you know, machine equipment, it could be a car, it could be, you know, whatever. Then you're going to have higher prices. And so the semiconductor issue is real, and that's both a consolidation and kind of bad market structure management from our policymakers. And we're trying to fix that with some legislation. That'll take some time. But the other one that's really easy to understand is the shipping problem. Hmm. So in the 1970s, there were probably 50 different shipping firms, something like that. I'm going to make up the number, but it was a lot of different shipping firms. And you had, they had different size boats. And America has a lot of ports, and those ports have, they can all accept small boats. Most of them can accept medium sized boats. Very few of them can accept large boats, and almost none of them can accept really, 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 really big boats. Well, what happened is because of a set of rules that rule changes in the 80s and then in the last one in 1998, the industry consolidated. So now you have three shipping firms, three what are called alliances. They're basically like it's a cartels of that control 80-90% of the shipping industry, including most of the vital east-west shipping links. So that from China to the port of LA Long Beach, and the ports of LA Long Beach accept about 40% of imports. So those firms, they have just giant, what are called ultra large container ships, and they can only really go to one or two ports. So if you have, these firms like to have such massive ships because it makes it really hard for anyone else to enter the industry. Because in order to enter the industry, you need to buy a really, really, really big ship, and that's really expensive. But what it means is that if you have too much stuff coming in, you can't go to other ports. You just have like these really giant ships that are carrying most stuff. And you know, sometimes you have very like basic problems, like one of the ships doesn't fit through the Suez Canal. Like really, really big ship in a really small space, like generally a bad idea. But you also have a lack of resiliency, which is what we've done because of the consolidation, which was first it was corporate consolidation, but then it led to the we're basically reliant on these really, you know, giant ships that are pretty, it's a more brittle system. And that has, you know, if you look at just some back of the envelope calculations, it would be the equivalent, what the delays that we have now are the equivalent of a 20% increase in tariffs, right? That's what the equivalent, globalization like had a deflationary impact for a long time because we were importing cheap stuff. Basically, it was about paying people less abroad to make the same things that we were making here. whether that was, you know, probably a bad decision, but like we, it's the choice that we made. But now we're actually importing inflation because costs are going up abroad, but also we just can't get stuff through the ports now. And so there's all these delays. And so, yeah, so those two things, it's like the shipping and the semiconductors, those bottlenecks have caused substantial amounts of inflation. You also have consolidation in things like the meatpacking sector where, you know, as you noted, you know, it's like, well, Tyson Foods is always like, oh, well, we have to raise prices because of all of these cost increases, but somehow their margins keep going up. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's, and it's not like the cattle ranchers are seeing the increases either. So what you're, and that's true in across the farming, like across the agricultural space, it's true in a lot of areas where middlemen are driving up prices. So it's not that in that market power bottlenecks are the cause of inflation. The cause of inflation was obviously the supply and demand shock from COVID and then government spending and the Federal Reserve policies. But the actual like supply, the, you know, the ability to produce more supply, to just push more stuff into the market to meet that demand is lessened because of the choices that we've made to create these bottlenecks. I mean, after all, like what is a monopoly? A monopoly is basically a bottleneck that you profit from. Yeah. And if it's like, oh, we'd like to set up a toll booth. It's a great business model, right? If you have an economy and a public policy framework that's designed around encouraging people to set up bottlenecks and toll booths, it's a really bad thing when a crisis happens, because then everyone's like, oh, cool. I got my bottleneck and I'm just going to like squeeze, right? And that's what, essentially the economy that we have right now.
So and if like, you don't squeeze, numbers, but, you know. But, so like other people are squeezing too. So if you don't squeeze, right. Your prices aren't going to be competitive if you have these like consolidated industries, right?
Yeah, that's right. And also you could probably talk to your, you know, to other industries and be like, we'll all squeeze together. Right. Which is probably, which is like illegal, but the standards for investigating that kind of thing have been loosened. So it's really hard to actually bring a price fixing case at this point. But yeah, I mean, you've got it. It's to the point now where CEOs are regularly telling investors, you know, we're reducing supply. You know, they use a lot of euphemisms. They like to talk about a disciplined industry, you know, capital discipline, the, you know, we are the price leader and we're keeping an eye on our competitors and making sure that they follow these kinds of things. And these are not just, they're not just bragging to investors, they're signaling to competitors mm-hmm. to restrain supply and to raise prices. And that should be illegal. That is a restraint of trade. And the Sherman Act says restraints of trade are illegal. They're not just illegal, they're criminal, by the way. But it's, you know, we've really reduced the standards for, you know, for bringing these cases. And if we just said, look, price fixing, we're going to allow private litigators to, you know, to just bring suits and do discovery, which is like the standard thing. It's like, if you think that somebody is price gouging you and you go to a court and you say, here's some evidence that they're probably doing it, the court will let you then look for documents to substantiate your case. And then you bring it to trial. Right now, the standards are almost impossible to just getting to the document stage. If we could just change it so that you can just get to the document search stage easier, then what would happen is a lot of CEOs would think twice before exploiting their market power. There still would be inflation, right? And we don't really know how much this would affect things. We don't really know what is causing this inflation. It's probably a number of different factors, but it certainly would have an impact when you know, the Tyson Food CEO is like, yeah, let's raise beef prices or let's raise chicken prices. They would think twice about it and say, you know, are we really, can we really justify this? Or are we just sort of squeezing that bottleneck?
The Arizona iced tea guy keeping his cans at 99 cents is a fun case study in this. That actually
yeah,
is
he's still worth $4 billion. So he seems to be doing all right.
Right. And in fact, maybe more people are now buying those 99 cent cans than would otherwise yeah. be. Matt, this is a good segue into the last question I wanted to wrap our conversation up on, which is, maybe one of the silver linings, as I would see it, of the fact that we have this massive administrative state now, is that actually if you sort of change the governing philosophy and you have more sort of lena cons in the regulatory agencies, a lot of this is not. For instance, if I think about all the reforms that need to happen in the education system, it's sort of daunting and overwhelming because you need so much. But the regulators have so much power in their hands at this point that, you know, changing personnel and then changing the sort of governing philosophy and the mindset of personnel and persuading people that, you know, there needs to be a different way to look at this. And maybe there have been excesses of this free market fundamentalism over the last several decades. It seems to me that in and of itself is incredibly constructive in this case because of the fact that regulators have so much power to deal with these issues.
That's a good question. You know, the courts have really put a lot of restrictions on what regulators can do. And there's a lot of, I mean, the government is, you know, the deep state is real, and there are just a large number of people in every agency that are really hostile to the idea of actually governing. So it is really hard. What I think would be like, if you wanted to really create massive change and do it relatively quickly, it really depends, I think, on Congress. And if the Republican Party does change its policymaking philosophy, away and move away from the libertarian corporatist framework towards a kind of more populist approach, and, you know, then it's kind of game over for the monopolists, right? Then it's like, okay, yeah, you change things, and, you know, you'll see the world will just it will just be crazy how quickly things change, you know, I think in a positive direction. But right now you have, you know, a chunk of the Democratic Party, like a pretty big chunk, but not everyone, that is kind of interested in doing things differently, is like, okay, well, what we did under Obama really was didn't deliver. And we're not happy with consolidated power. And they're confused, right? They're not totally, you know, they're like, a lot of them are like, we don't like this consolidated power. We want censorship, but we don't like this consolidated power. So there's like confusion there. And there's definitely a chunk of people that don't want to do it. But on the Republican side, the voters really want governing. They really want the government to start to like crack down on this consolidated power. Mm-hmm. But the establishment is just not there yet. Like the faction that is reflecting the will of right-wing voters is much less powerful than the faction that is kind of like representing, I guess, Disney and Google right now, right? I mean, there's an election coming up, and it's likely that the Republicans are going to win a lot. And so who knows what that new, like, I don't know what those new Republicans are going to think about these questions. And I'm guessing that most of those Republicans who are running for office don't know what they think about them either. So this is kind of like the open question. You have members like Mitch McConnell and Jim Jordan, who are really hostile to populism and are really hostile to addressing these problems. And then you have members, you know, you have other members who are, you know, and you know who they are, who are, who actually want stronger, you know, who have a different philosophy. I mean, it really is a philosophical shift. And I think, you know, so goes the Republican establishment, so goes the judiciary, right? Because you have all of these judges who were appointed, many of them, not all of them, but many of them by Trump. And a lot of them are paying attention to these debates and they are interested. And I think, generally speaking, they are probably more establishment, libertarian, free market oriented, but they're open, I think, to new ways of thinking about the world and changing their minds. I mean, everybody noticed when Trump got deplatformed, right? And that it is impossible to, if you're a conservative, from what I can understand, no, I'm not a conservative, but to say, yeah, I'm totally for the free market's right to deplatform Donald Trump, right? It's a hard, it's difficult to square that circle. But, you know, Jim Jordan is a really good politician. He's able to do that. But the question is, how long, right? How long are people going to, you know, he'll flip if the voters like start telling him, we don't like this, we want you to be aggressive. But it's like, how long does that process take? How do you build those new institutional networks? How do you build that knowledge? How do you, like, that's kind of the open question on the Republican side. And if the Republicans don't do it, right, then the Republicans will get their majorities and then they'll lose their majorities, right? Yeah. I mean, that's what keeps happening. You know, since 2006, it's just been, you know, 2006, 2008, 2010, 2014, 2016, 2018, 2020, probably 2022, all of which are change elections. And that is going to keep happening until somebody says, you know what, the problem here is consolidation of economic and political power so that we have no control over our lives. When somebody finally figures out that that is the central problem that American people want someone to take on and take it on in a way that actually makes people's lives better, that party will govern for quite some time.
Yeah, it's interesting. The Fox merger was approved under Trump, but Ron DeSantis is, you know, if anyone's picking up this mantle, it's one of the most popular Republicans with the conservative movement and with the Republican base in the country, Ron DeSantis, and perhaps a...
He's no dummy.
Right, right. Well, and perhaps an optimistic anecdote. Matt, you wrote a great post when Justice Breyer announced his retirement about his dubious history on antitrust. And right. When I was talking to Marsha Blackburn about how she was vetting Ketanji Jackson, I asked her if she was, since Justice Jackson would be replacing Justice Breyer, vetting her thoroughly on antitrust. And she proactively was doing that and said, absolutely, yes. And it's a good example, again, of sort of a mainstream Republican who has taken up the issue, I think, a lot, in large part because of the malfeasance of big tech. I actually think that's the Republican Party is really coming around, as you point out, Matt.
Yeah, I mean, it would be hard for me to, so I want to just put something on your radar because I think it's, like, there are very obvious, each party, there are things that cannot be said in either party, right? So I'm going to say something that cannot be said in the Republican Party, but I think is important, which is that the Republicans, you know, the Federal Trade Commission has just, for the last, like, 30 years, has kind of been this place where you, like, put your, like, political crony that didn't get the position they really wanted. Yeah. You're like, oh yeah, he's a donor. Let's give him an FTC slot, right? It's like this, you know, you get to go to Paris and privacy conferences. It's like a cushy job.
But hell yeah, actually, privacy conferences.
Yeah, no, but it's like, oh, I need to go and like network at the OECD. You mean you want to go to Paris, right? Like right. That's what it is. But that's because they didn't do anything because antitrust has been dead antitrust consumer protection has been pretty dead for like 20, 30 years. But it's not anymore. And under Trump in 2020, the FTC actually brought an antitrust case saying we want to break up Facebook. It was a 3-2 vote to bring that case, but it wasn't a partisan vote. It was the two Democrats who were on the FTC was Rohit Chopra and Becca Kelly Slaughter, who actually voted to bring the case, as did Trump's chair, who is a guy named Joe Simons. But the two Republicans who are libertarian establishment types, Christine Wilson and Noah Phillips, voted against bringing the case. Now, the case was dismissed by an Obama judge, and then Lina Khan brought it back and refiled it. And so basically it was Trump's case, and they changed it a little bit to satisfy the judge. And it was a 3-2 vote. But this time it was partisan because it was all three Democrats who voted for it. But Christine Wilson and Noah Phillips were still at the FTC. Republicans voted against it. And they voted against, you know, Trump's agenda on Made in America fraud, where you can mislabel things as Made in America when they're not. They voted against taking on pharmacy benefits managers. They voted against, like, you know, Made in America fraud involved meat packing. So that's up against cattle ranchers and this kind of populist agenda. They are really hostile to this populist agenda. And one of the FTC commissioners, a Democrat, went over to Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, where he's actually addressing some things around big tech and finance, which is pretty interesting. But what that meant is that there are now two Republicans and two Democrats on the FTC. And so the FTC can't do very much because it can be blocked by Noah and Christine, who are both blocking all action by the FTC. They're not like picking the things not all action, but almost everything. And so that's why, I don't know why the FTC didn't challenge Amazon buying MGM, but it was a, there were four commissioners, right? There was not a majority for it. So my guess is that it's that Noah and Christine didn't, you know, refuse to challenge it. And this is a huge problem. And the Republicans, you know, they're, you know, they have their partisan interests, and I respect that. But there is a fifth commissioner who is sitting out there, and his name is Alvaro Bedoya, and he said some dumb things. He said some insulting things about Republicans on Twitter. And he's, you know, he's like a standard Democratic establishment guy. But the Republicans are holding up the nomination. It's a 50-50, like, you know, they're just trying to make sure that he doesn't get confirmed, kind of sort of for partisan reasons. And I get that, and I get why you wouldn't necessarily trust someone like that. But the net effect of it is it's breaking the ability of the FTC to function. And there are two choices that the Republicans have if they want to actually have some sort of action on antitrust. One is you can approve the Democrat, right? Mm-hmm. Which I can understand why Republicans wouldn't want to do that, right? Some of them voted for Lena Khan. They voted for John Cantor. They have a demonstrated track record of taking on big tech in a way that I think, you know, some other Democrats don't. So I get why they wouldn't want to do that. But the other one, the other option is to yell at Noah and Christine, mm-hmm. and say, stop breaking the antitrust enforcement, right? And that would have a big impact because, you know, Noah and Christine are really afraid of getting criticized by the, not even getting criticized, of getting noticed, right? Christine right. Wilson is literally at the Chamber of Commerce giving speeches saying, you, the Chamber of Commerce, needs to rise up against the FTC and our tyranny against the business community. Like, she is saying things like that, right? She is saying, you know, these crypto Marxists, critical race theorists at the FTC are trying to engage in, you know, whatever it is. Like, she's ginning up that kind of nonsense culture war stuff. It's not true. That's not what, like, bringing a case against Amazon MGM is not like yeah. critical race theory, crypto Marxism. Like, but she's, you know, that's what yes. she's doing. And like, Noah Phillips is, you know, he's smarter, but he's less energetic, but he's doing something similar. And it's like, put a spotlight on these people, right? So that the FTC can function, right? The best scenario here is not that the Democrats get a majority and start to, like, you know, crack down on big tech. The best scenario here is that the Republicans join in and start taking on big tech mm-hmm. and start to, like, take on the, on an institutional level in terms of antitrust. Because once you have a populist R actually saying, you know what, we're going to hold back some of the things that the Democrats want to do, but we're going to go hard on corporate power, maybe harder than what the Democrats even want to do. That's when, like, the bipartisan consensus flips, right, away from we need to defer to corporate power to, okay, prove to us that you should have this amount of consolidated economic and political power, not like, not the other way around. And that, so that's where I think, like, it would just be really helpful if the right noticed that there was this huge problem at the Federal Trade Commission. And this would then set up when, you know, the Republicans win, right? They're likely going to win now, but the next time they win, whether it's in 2024 or 2028, whatever it is, right? If that fight doesn't happen now, then the next FTC chair under DeSantis or whoever is going to be Christine Wilson, mm-hmm. right? Or is going to be Noah Phillips, or is going to be someone like that. Like, the next antitrust division chief is going to be somebody who would, you know, maybe approve Disney Fox, right? So it's like, you know, getting into the fight with the deep state on your side would be really helpful, and it would set you guys up to actually take on corporate power.
It's such a fascinating insight into the power of personnel and regulatory personnel. And if there are any Republican members of Congress listening, which I know there are, listen to Matt. And if your staffers are listening, which I know they are, listen to Matt. Matt Stoller, subscribe to his Substack at mattstoller.substack.com. It's called Big. It's super helpful. The book Goliath is super helpful. It'll give you a new understanding of, or a deeper and probably new understanding of so many things that are happening right now. Matt Stoller, thank you so much for joining Federalist Radio Hour.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Of course. You've been listening to another edition of Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at The Federalist. We will be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray. Today.